As President Trump issues a new warning to Iran, his Secretary of War in Senate testimony yesterday continues to tell everybody that Iran is functionally defeated, that it's only a matter of time, and soon we are going to have that darn pesky Strait of Hormuz open back up. Don't worry about it. Everything will be fine. At least that's what he's saying. Now, of course, if you look at the reality on the ground, shall we say things are a little bit different. And the idea that Iran is going to start waving that white flag might be a little bit premature. And to try to help us explain some of this stuff and find out what's actually going on the Iranian side, we have back with us Professor Saeed Mohammad Mirandi, professor at Tehran University, former advisor to the Iran's nuclear negotiating team and combat veteran from the Iran-Iraq war. Professor, as always, welcome back to the show.
It's always a great pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, listen, I just want to jump into some of the Senate testimony, because some of it just and I did a show earlier today on some of these same sound bites and some others that were different. And it's just anguishing to me to see the level to which fiction has moved up to the level of attempted reality when the evidence is so strongly refuting it. And yet it's with conviction it's conveyed. Let me just show you one here that we didn't talk about this morning. And that is with Senator Gillibrand talking to Secretary of War Pete Hegseth about what he said about 4 months ago.
Quote, Iran's entire ballistic missile production capacity, every company that builds every component of those missiles has been functionally defeated and destroyed, and that the missile program, existing stockpiles were depleted and decimated, almost completely ineffective. So why are there missiles left to hit Jordan and result in the loss of life of our brave men and women?
As we stated from the beginning, the Iranian defense industrial base is effectively gone. But they do have underground facilities because they're the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism, and they've spent 47 years trying to hide their missiles under mountains,
just like their
nuclear capabilities, because they would like to get
just
a nuclear weapon to wield it against us.
Don't know what version of the war to believe, because it's either over or it's not over. It's within 2 weeks or it's not 2 weeks. We have no missiles or we have missiles.
Yeah, and look, I mean, we'll just state the obvious here. This is the current targeting list here of the types of missiles that Iran has been using here in the last week. So if he wanted to claim in 4 months ago that your capacity to make missiles was effectively defeated, and even repeats it now that they are functionally defeated here, then one wonders why are all these targets getting hit from the American side going on. Now, what is your assessment?
I think we all know the answer. They are deceiving the American people. They've launched a war not on behalf of the American people, but on behalf of the Israeli regime, the Zionist lobby, Netanyahu. And this is the result. And people want answers, but they don't have any answers to give because they were arrogant from the very beginning. They made up stories at the start, hoping or expecting that the war would be over in a couple of days or a week or so. And that didn't happen. And now all the things that they said back then are coming back to haunt them. Iran does not only have very large quantities of missiles and very large quantities of drones. They're producing missiles and drones in large numbers as we speak. They're factories are underground. Their production facilities are all well protected. And the bases where all those missiles and drones are kept are also underground. And so are a lot of other key assets. Iran's speedboats are underground. Iran's anti-air defense capabilities are underground. A lot of its air force is underground. They were expecting this war. They've been planning this war since the beginning, since after the fall of the war with Saddam Hussein, where the United States helped Saddam back then, but especially after 9/11, after the United States came and invaded Afghanistan and Iraq, and Wesley Clark said that the United States plans to invade seven countries in 5 years, the last being Iran, and when I think the vice president said real men go to Tehran, or someone high up in the Bush administration. Since then, Iran has been working nonstop to build up its defenses for what they believed was going to eventually happen. And therefore, that's why we see today the Iranians are firing missiles day and night, outgunning Trump and causing enormous damage across the board. And instead of implementing an MOU, instead of normalizing the situation in the Persian Gulf, in the region, Trump went and undermined that MOU and restarted a war that he'd already gone through just 3-4 months ago. We had 40 days of fighting. What has changed that Trump now thinks he's going to be able to gain victory over Iran when he couldn't back then?
Now, you mentioned what President Trump is thinking. Here's what he's saying. This is this morning here a couple of hours ago. He said, from this point forward, anytime the Islamic Republic of Iran shoots a ship in the Strait of Hormuz, whether it be by missile, rocket, drone, or any other device or weapon, the United States will bomb or destroy one bridge or power plant, including those next to or in the capital city of Tehran. What is the reaction from Tehran, from the Republic of Iran?
Well, during the 40-day war, the Ramadan war, the Iranians warned the United States that if Iran's critical infrastructure is attacked, Iran will strike back at those regimes in the region that are facilitating war against Iran. They're conspiring against the Iranians alongside the United States. And one instance that you remember as well as I was when they bombed Iran's major gas field, Iran's most important gas field, the South Pars gas field. And Iran immediately struck back very hard. And among Iran's targets was the Qatari gas field, and they caused enormous damage. And Trump quickly put out a post in Truth Social saying that this will not happen again. And Iran has been saying since then, and during the last 11, 12 days of war, they've been saying that if the United States targets our critical infrastructure, we will destroy the critical infrastructure of the regimes on the other side of the Persian Gulf. And we are at the, it's the month of July, and the heat in the Persian Gulf region, as you know better than I, and in the Arabian Peninsula is through the roof, and the humidity is through the roof. And so if Iran is forced to retaliate for deterrence and destroy their critical infrastructure, these regimes will collapse. They're not like Iran. Iran, 1% of the Iranian population perhaps uses desalination plants, for example. These countries are, some of them are almost 100% dependent on desalination plants. Iran has four seasons. In some parts of the country, it's cool. In some parts of the country, we have deserts. These are all deserts. They have nothing but oil or gas. So if their critical infrastructure goes, these countries are gone.
And what do you make of, let me show you one of the other comments here. You mentioned the underground facilities. This is something that Iran has spent decades preparing for. You just laid that out here. We cover that all the time with the, you know, images like this one from the Yazd facility, one representative. And I think, as you've told us on previous episodes, there's like 30 some odd of these, maybe even more, scattered throughout the country. So unless you can take one of them out, unless you can take all of them out, that capability is going to continue to reside. Now, it finally got a little bit testy during the Senate hearing with a friendly senator, a Republican Senator Kennedy, who asked about a mountain.
Guys, we need straight answers. We need straight answers. Do we have the ability to destroy whatever is underneath Pickaxe Mountain?
A lot of our capabilities are classified, but if anybody in the world can reach anything on this, on God's green earth, it's the United States military, the most powerful military in the world. It's all about options and trade-offs.
Yeah, okay. Is it about options and trade-offs, though, or is it about effectiveness? Can you do it or can you not? Let's start with this. What is at Pickaxe Mountain as far as you can reveal?
I really don't know. And there are things I don't know, many things that I don't know. And I really don't ask because it's of no use to me. I mean, I don't know, for example, if the nuclear facilities that were bombed, whether they were really damaged or not, if they're all if they're functioning or not. I have no idea because these are, you know, top secret. But what I can say is that everything that Iran has built so far underground, and there are more than 30 some bases, as far as I know, there are over between 50 and 60 underground missile bases. Then there are drone bases, there are underground factories, and Iran is developing them by the day. But what I do know is not a single base has been destroyed, not one of them. So this mountain or that mountain, what we've seen so far is that all the bases that the Iranians have used to fire their missiles and drones, they're all functioning. The Americans, the Trump government cannot name a single missile base that which has been destroyed or which is no longer in operation. They're all in operation. Some of them, and I think it was the Yazd base that you alluded to, some of them were repeatedly bombed by P-52 bombers, B-52 bombers, repeatedly, and yet nothing happened. So if that's the case, and I don't see how they're going to destroy anything else with their current capabilities. But the point is that this is a war of aggression. The United States carried out an illegal and unprovoked war. We just had the funerals where they've been trying to find the bits and pieces of the bodies of the little girls who were murdered in Minab on the first day of the war, what I believe to be an intentional act of war. I've been in war operations. I know that on day one of operations, all the targets are very well vetted for many months. For me, it's just impossible to believe that the United States did not know that this was a school. So we've had the funerals, and this is all a war of aggression. And now the Americans, the senators, and are talking about whether we can win or not. No one is saying that this is a war of aggression. This is an unjustified war. You murdered their leaders. You've murdered their children. You've destroyed their infrastructure. You're terrorizing the public. Trump constantly says he's going to destroy the country and take it back to the Stone Age. But I don't see a single senator, not like five or six, not a single senator will come out and say, what is this? What are you doing? I mean, you're behaving like Israelis. And the senators, I think like Israelis.
And I want to say it was, I'm not sure I'm going to say the right one here, but I think Senator Murphy was asking about, what have we been doing to try and win? She also asked him about some of the things that he had said early in the war. And in his answer here, he seems to keep going back to the fact that it's this nuclear weapons program. That's what it was really all about. And that's what we had to go and defend. Watch this.
Sorry, Dan, which one are you looking for? Murphy?
Senator Murphy. It may be the first one here, I think.
Quote, Iran's entire ballistic missile production capacity.
That was the old first one.
In the second week of the conflict, you stated that Iran's military had been, quote, destroyed and, quote, made combat ineffective. Was that an accurate statement?
What the American military has done to the Iranian military is a historic military defeat, and they're ineffective in that context.
Secretary, early in the conflict, day three, you said one of those core objectives was to, quote, destroy the missile threat, and as you restated on day five, to, quote, obliterate Iran's missiles and drones. Those were clearly and repeatedly stated core objectives of the campaign, which 4 months ago you declared had been completed victoriously with every single objective achieved. Were those objectives achieved 4 months ago?
No one ever stated that every single missile was gone. Ultimately, combat ineffective means they're not able to dig them out of their UGFs and shoot
had
at
the
us.
Missile threat
it doesn't mean they don't have underground
4 months
facilities
ago.
Where they put missiles in them and hold on to them because they're the world's largest state sponsor of terrorism. So we never expected they would stop having capabilities to shoot. The question is at scale against an opponent like the United States of America.
Sorry, that wasn't the one I was thinking of. But then again, he goes back to this, the largest state sponsor of terrorism. How do you respond to that?
Because he said this in another clip, too, that you showed. Because they're the world's largest or state sponsor of terrorism, they put their missiles underground. So if you're not a state sponsor of terrorism, always keep your missiles on the ground. That's the, you know, that's how you can gauge the difference between being a terrorist and being a non-terrorist.
I mean, the whole thing was kind of embarrassing here. I think this might be the one I was thinking
of. The United States says they're not coming back into the table.
Sorry, I've just messed this all up. I won't get back into that. But let me just go into some other stuff that's more important here. In addition to what President Trump said, while the Iranian side does still have missile capacity, and while we're going through ours, we do still have it. And so when he says he's going to attack some things, this is what was just attacked, and I think it was just overnight, which is the largest attack the United States has launched against all these different sites. And you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think in none of these locations here are any of these, the mountain, the missile cities, the underground facilities. These were all things that were on the surface. So we are hitting things, and it does hurt the Iranian side. What can you tell us about the impact these targets here that we hit overnight are having on the Iran side?
Well, I don't have all the information, obviously, but some of the things that I do know is that the Americans are often hitting sites that are that have decoys. The Iranians have planted decoys everywhere, and they're moving around their assets all the time. Ever since the 12-day war, Iran has changed the way in which it conducts warfare. So, for example, when the United States bombs a military base, there's usually no one there. And the Iranians have been, as I said, developing more underground command and control centers, more underground missile and drone bases, but also its other assets are constantly being moved around so that the United States won't be able to destroy them, and drones are used extensively. So, for example, a friend of mine who lives near one of the places that was struck, I'm not sure, I spoke with him today, but I don't know if it was last night or the night before. He said that they struck a place very close to his home, like for the 20th time since the beginning of the war, since 4 or 5 months ago. So they're constantly hitting old targets, or they're hitting empty buildings, because the Iranians, unlike the Americans, you see that the problem with the Americans right now, I mean, the fact that it's aggression and all that aside, the problem that the Americans have is that all of their bases and assets are out in the open. They have these bases which they built decades ago, and they are not built for the age of drones and missiles. And the Iranians, knowing that the United States has much greater firepower, they, since for decades, have been developing missiles and drones and underground bases, because they knew that if they built a lot of drones and missiles and the U.S. Air Force came and attacked, they would do exactly what the U.S. Secretary of War claimed they did. They would destroy everything. So the Americans are clearly at a disadvantage. And now that the Iranians are destroying all these bases in the Persian Gulf, the Americans are forced to retreat to places like Jordan and Saudi Arabia and the Israeli regime. And then there are further problems. First of all, they're not able to organize well. Second of all, you're the expert, and I shouldn't be saying this to you, and correct me wherever I'm wrong. It becomes difficult for them to command and control. It's also more difficult for them to carry out attacks. But also, these bases are not designed to hold all this equipment and all these people. So, and then the Iranians have the capabilities to strike those bases too, as we're seeing in Saudi Arabia and Jordan. So, and a lot of these, for example, F-15s, they're not being held. Are not being taken care of in ideal conditions. The F-35s or whatever is out there in these different bases. So the big advantage that Iran has is that whatever is really important to it, it's not out in the open. And what is out in the open is replaceable.
Then you got to bring yourself back in.
All right, I got stuck. I was trying to pull up something here to show you a second ago. I want to go into really kind of the crux of this, because right now, if this was just a missile shot and just an exercise, and we shoot missiles at you, you shoot missiles back at us, and we've done it, sir. I think today's going to be the 12th consecutive day. I think Iran has already hit some targets this morning, so surely another American one is coming later today. Aside from the fact that there's no observable military end state for this, where this is even trying to object, if it was just that, that would be bad, because it's going to continue to drain at least our missile stocks, which apparently are getting lower. But there's a bigger issue that involved with the United States, and that is the price of oil. Now, the price of oil, the paper oil, has gone up. I think it's $87 right now. So that's already starting to be a big problem. But when you look at here, this is the actual spot price today, $131. That's what people are actually paying for a barrel of oil today, not the futures price, but the actual price here. And so that is going to continue going. That's what's driving everything else here. And all that, of course, is because the Strait of Hormuz remains to be closed. Now, interesting. Oh, wrong one. The United States Central Command, in their daily release from yesterday, says that despite Iranian aggression, the Strait of Hormuz remains open for commercial vessel transit. Since early May, Central Command forces have helped facilitate the transit of approximately 900 commercial vessels and 450 million barrels of oil. Now, that sounds impressive until you realize that since May, that's about 10 or 11 per day, which is about 10% of what it was before. And of course, as you see there, CNBC reported just yesterday that most of those that are going through are on the Iran-linked sanctioned vessels, continuing to dominate any movement. So what the Iran side has opened up is one of the only things going through here. So the question is, how long can Iran keep the Strait of Hormuz closed?
The problem, I think, that the Americans don't, the people around Trump don't seem to understand, or maybe they do, I don't know, is that for Iran, this is a war for survival. And Iran knows that the intentions of the United States, the Israeli regime, are to destroy the country. And they murdered the leader, they murdered hundreds of school kids, they bombed hospitals. They just last week, they bombed a children's hospital in Ahvaz, a cancer hospital for children, which was subsequently evacuated. So the Iranians know that they're going to be ruthless. You cannot raise the white flag and survive. And you cannot negotiate with the United States, because every time we've negotiated, the United States has they bombed us subsequently, like at the beginning of this war and at the beginning of last year's war. And of course, the United States, they signed the MOU and they began to violate it from day one. Israel did not leave South Lebanon. They continue to bomb the country. They continue to refrain from handing over Iranian assets. And the list goes on. And of course, then they set up their own corridor in violation of Article 5 in the Strait of Hormuz and all that, which your audience knows. So the Iranians know their only option is to fight and to make sure that Trump feels defeated. And until the United States reaches a point where it can no longer be a threat to Iran. For the United States, what does it have to, why is it fighting? Who knows? They're not fighting for the American people. They're not fighting to protect the country. They're not fighting to protect their citizens. It's all about the Israeli regime. It's all about the interests of Netanyahu and the Zionist lobby in the United States. So the motivation that exists in Iran is very different from in the United States. People are going to be steadfast and tough. So if the United States starts hitting our critical infrastructure, and which means basically targeting women and children, obviously, the Iranians are going to be steadfast. And what are the Iranians going to be forced to do? They're going to have to target they can't target critical infrastructure in the United States. So they're going to target critical infrastructure of those regimes that facilitated the war. What is that going to lead to? It's going to lead to the destruction of all of those regimes, because all of their assets, their key assets, are right in front of Iran. Even the Saudis, who have a pipeline that go to the Red Sea, The oil wells are here. They're near the Persian Gulf. All of them are easily destroyed. So if that happens, then millions of people will have to leave for Iraq or for Yemen or somewhere else. And then these countries will collapse, and then we will definitely have a global economic depression, I think far worse than the 1930s. And then we know what happened after the 1930s.
Yes, we do. And that is an outcome that I do not wish to see repeated. What can we make? You talk about the fact that the United States has basically made themselves immune to having a negotiated settlement because we haven't kept to anything that we've said. And I mean, if we only limit ourselves to the 2025 war, the start of this war, and then what happened with the Memorandum of Understanding, there doesn't seem to be much basis for anybody in Iran to say, yeah, let's have another round of negotiations. And yet, according to Arab media and the Western media here the last couple of days, apparently some in Iran are willing to contemplate maybe another 10-day ceasefire. What can you tell us about that?
No, that's not true. That's not something that anyone in Iran has said. In fact, those who negotiated the MOU are being criticized by a large segment of the Iranian population and politicians for negotiating in the first place, because they're saying, look, you negotiated a deal, the Americans had time to regroup and get some oil out of the Strait of Hormuz and then effectively push the region towards war again by undermining the MOU. Now, those who supported the deal, they say, well, we knew this was going to happen, but we needed to export a large amount of oil that was stuck in the Persian Gulf. And so we used that window to export tens of millions of barrels of oil and import goods to prepare ourselves for the next phase of the war. Both sides have valid arguments to make. I'm not in any particular camp. But the point is that the argument right now that exists, the debate that exists, is definitely not about a ceasefire so that the Americans can regroup.
And of course, if it was only the Strait of Hormuz and all the things I said would be a big issue, but you mentioned the Saudi pipelines that goes through Yanbu and then has been going out through the Bab al-Mandab. But now, according to Ansar Allah, yesterday, the Houthis here in the West, all of a sudden that is closed. And we had some ships yesterday turned around. I haven't seen this morning's traffic. But what can you tell us about that? Is that an actual thing? Is it actually shut down, or is it something that could come back open?
Well, one of the different types of paper oil is now at $94 or so. It was before the show, at least. So obviously, this is having an impact. The amazing thing is that, and this is what I heard, I don't know if it's true, but I think it is, because I've heard it from at least two people who I consider to be pretty credible. The Saudis, when the Iranians sent a plane to Yemen, a commercial plane with a crew, men, women, like all commercial planes in Iran. They sent a plane to the capital of Yemen and picked up a delegation for the funeral. And then they went back. They flew back. And then when they were close to the airport in Yemen, the Saudis bombed the airport. And so this was an Iranian plane, an Iranian crew, maybe a few Iranian passengers, I don't know, but I know that the Yemeni delegation and some Yemeni people who are in hospital in Iran for being treated, some Yemeni people went back with the flight. So for Yemen, this was an act of war. For Iran, it angered the Iranians a great deal because of what they did to a civilian flight, but endangering it. But for Yemen, this was an act of war. And so Yemen, which has been under siege for many years by the Saudis and their coalition, the Saudis carried out a genocidal war in Yemen against Yemen with the Emirates and other countries in the region with the support of the West, not very different from what we saw in Gaza for years. And then Yemen began to develop drone technology and missile technology. I'm pretty sure Iran helped them. I mean, I'm not saying that they don't have indigenous capabilities They don't have engineers. I'm sure they do, very smart people, but probably the Iranians helped them develop it further. So they began to fire missiles and drones at Saudi Arabia, and that's what led to the ceasefire. But the siege remained. Now Yemen, after this assault on the airport, is saying that the siege has to go. We will not accept the siege anymore. So this was a very stupid move by the Saudis. And those two people who I know said that the Americans pushed the Saudis into doing this, which I think was even more stupid, because the Americans already, you know, Trump already has enough on his hands with Iran. He fought Yemen early on in his presidency. He did not win there. And now what is he going to do? Fight Iran and Yemen at the same time? He's not winning on either front. So Yemen has the capability to keep the Bab al-Mandab closed to Saudi Arabia. And from my understanding, this morning, there is the traffic is like it was the day before. So ships are not going to the Saudi ports.
And apparently they can't go through the Suez Canal in the north either, because the most of the VLCCs are too large to get through in terms of tonnage, et cetera. So it's either Bab al-Mandab or it's they just roll around in the Red Sea, but they don't get out. We'll have to see how that works.
Or smaller tankers, which can go through the Red Sea, would have to go all around Africa. So they're smaller tankers. It's more expensive. They'd have to go all, and then when they return, since they can't go through the Bab al-Mandab, they'd have to go all around Africa too. So it's going to hit Saudi exports very hard and imports.
Yeah, and we'll see how long they can support that, because one of the things that for Saudi Arabia, even throughout this war, is because they were able to get oil out through, I think it's that pipeline that went out through the southern part of Oman, so they went into the Gulf of Oman and through the Yanbu port here. They got out a little bit less than they had, but because the price of oil went up, their income was about the same. This would put a major, major crimp on Saudi Arabia, and one wonders how many days or weeks or months they can go without the oil income to sustain their standard of living in their country. So that's a potential friction point that we'll have to see how it plays out. I want to shift gears a little bit to another country in the region. You may have heard of them. They're called Israel. They are making some interesting statements here recently, and I wonder how you view this. Now, I think it's pretty clear at this point that the Benjamin Netanyahu personally encouraged and convinced President Trump to go ahead and join them in this war on February 28th, claiming that if they assassinated Ali Khamenei, that the Iranian government would fall or that the people would rise up, whatever. We obviously know how that worked out, the exact opposite of what we had hoped. But whatever, that was the whole thing in this 40 days of war was between the United States and Israel against Iran. Well, now then, since we've gone back into it here, this has been the Americans that have gone back for 11 straight days. And according to many sources out of the Iranian, out of the Israeli side, they're saying, you know what, we're fine with that. Why don't y'all just keep fighting this war for a long time? And to me, that is, at least as an American, that is one of the more perverse things I've seen, because the Israeli side convinced us to go in with our armed forces. And now then they're saying, I'm fine with this war between the United States and Iran and not us in Iran. So that way we're not on the receiving end of any Iranian missiles, and it's not our people who are dying, it's the Americans who are dying. What do you make of that?
It just goes to show what the nature of the relationship between the Israeli regime and the United States is. It is a one-way relationship. One side benefits and the other side is hurt, and it's hurt in many different ways. The image of the United States since Gaza has been, if not completely demolished, very badly damaged. The military in the United States has suffered a great deal, as again, you would know much better than I. The economy has been suffering thanks to the Israeli regime. I mean, the Israeli regime its existence is detrimental to the interests of the United States. It's a burden to the United States. But I would like to point something else as something out here, and that is that what Iran is doing is that it is destroying all of the defensive capabilities that the United States has created over the decades in the Persian Gulf region, in northern Iraq, and in Syria. I mean, Syria, it's a bit different, but in any case, the radar bases, the the installations there to protect the Israeli regime or U.S. assets from drones and missiles, these are all being destroyed. And so if there's an, except for in Turkey where they have their radar and system there. But so if a war breaks out between the Israeli regime and Iran, the Israeli regime is not going to have the advantages that it had before. The second issue, the second point is that some may ask, why doesn't Iran strike the Israeli regime now? I think there are three reasons for that. One is that this war is about the Strait of Hormuz. And Iran wants to focus on the Strait and to make sure that the United States fails. The second reason is that the second point is that Iran never initiates war. It doesn't, even though many people attack Iran, even Iranian supporters online attack Iran, say, you should have a nuclear weapon, you're foolish, you're stupid, you should, you know, start the war, you're being idiots, they're going to destroy you. I hear that a lot. And from people who are really sincerely supporting Iran from across the globe. But Iran does not start wars. That's just how it is. It's their religious belief and they won't do it. So, but there's a third reason too. And that is that the Israeli regime is in crisis. There is internal crisis and there's election coming on. And the crisis is bigger than what many of us seem to think. I read some of the material in Conflicts Forum that they produce by Alistair Crook's wife, Aisling. About in turn what she translates and puts out material on Hebrew from the Hebrew press in the Israeli regime. And the divisions are very deep and dangerous. So right now, the Iranians are just watching and waiting and looking at the situation inside the regime. And it would prefer not to do something that would unite the different political forces behind Netanyahu right now. They'd like to see these clashes continue. But if Netanyahu and his coalition fire a missile at Iran, then there will be war and Iran will hit back very hard. So, but in any case, Iran is preparing the grounds for war because they are destroying all those radar installations and all those assets that are there to protect the Israeli regime, as well as the United States forces.
Now, there has, speaking of these Israel, there has been some reporting here of late where some of the statements made by some of the senior Israeli leaders, Benjamin Netanyahu being one of them, that imply that if Iran does go back and start striking Iran, that they would hit them in ways harder before, giving the implication it could be a nuclear weapon. Is there any concern on the Iranian side that they may one day be the recipient of an Iranian Israeli nuclear weapon?
Well, first of all, he said this before on many occasions. But first of all, the very fact that he says this sort of thing, I think just exposes the Israeli regime further in the eyes of humanity for what it really is. But also, I don't think that the Israeli regime would survive such an attack. First of all, the world won't accept it. And the regime is already despised and it is hated across the world. And so that's one issue. The second is that Iran is a very big country. And Iran has no plans to produce nuclear weapons. In the 1980s, when the United States supported Saddam Hussein and the West gave him chemical weapons to use against Iranians, and as I may have said on your show, I survived two chemical attacks myself. I survived a nerve agent in the Khaybar operation, and I survived mustard gas in 1988. So I know these things a bit, you know, firsthand. Iranian leaders and politicians went to the leader, Ayatollah Khomeini, back then and said, we need chemical weapons. And the West was preventing Iran from even purchasing gas masks. So Ayatollah Khomeini said, no, this is an inhumane weapon and you're not allowed to make it. And you have to fight the war without it. This idea continued under Ayatollah Khamenei. He gave a fatwa, as we all know. And there's no evidence that Iran has ever, I mean, the IAEA has never produced any evidence that Iran was ever producing a nuclear weapon. And the United States admits that at least since 2003, Iran has not been attempting to build a nuclear weapon. Before 2003, it wasn't either, but that's another. And there's a good book on this, by the way. There are two good books. One is called Manufactured Crisis by Gareth Porter. And another is A Dangerous Delusion.
Gareth, good friend of mine.
Yeah, an excellent guy. And another is A Dangerous Delusion by Peter Oborne, who's British. Alongside the two books that I once mentioned on your show, Going to Tehran by the Leverets and Resistance by our mutual friend Alistair Crook. So the Iranians were not producing a nuclear weapon, but the Dr. Larijani, who was martyred in this war, who was the chair of the Supreme National Security Council, once said, not when he was the chair of the council, but when he was a representative of the leader, he said that if there's, I'm paraphrasing, I may have forgotten exactly what he said, but he said that if there is an imminent threat to Iran's existence, Iran's nuclear posture would change. And Dr. Kharazi, who was a foreign minister under President Khatami, he too said the same thing. He was also murdered in the war by the Americans and Israelis. So I would assume that if there is an imminent threat, that what a nuclear a threat, a credible nuclear threat against Iran would be considered an imminent threat. And as I said, Iran has many capabilities. It's highly advanced. We're seeing that in this war. It chooses not to have a nuclear weapon. But if there's going to be a threat to its existence, then I think things could change. I don't know if I was disconnected or not because I lost your image.
No, you're very good. No, we just sometimes want to focus on you. What is the effect so far? Yesterday on Fox News yesterday, Scott Bessent said that the sanctions are having a crippling effect on the Iranian economy, that inflation is up 180%, store shelves are empty, people are losing their jobs, and it is starting to really bite across the ground. What is the truth on the ground there?
Well, you know, that's what they've been saying since I was a teenager, that Iran is always falling apart, it's collapsing. The regime, they love to say regime, the regime is on the verge of collapse. It's highly unpopular. They're incapable of self-governance. But this evil regime won't go away. And it's still here. And you have all these millions of evil people on the streets, mourning for the leader and mourning for the children who were murdered. I mean, they live in their alternative universe. Yes, of course. When you impose a siege, when you bomb factories and schools and hospitals and apartment blocks, and you impose sanctions, of course life is going to be more difficult. But the Iranians are going to be resilient and resistant. It's, you know, this is a country with thousands of years of civilization, and its Shia religious identity, as Alistair Crook explains in his book Resistance quite well, it makes it particularly strong when opposing oppression, uniquely strong. That's what we see in Lebanon, that's what we see in Iran, that's what we see in Yemen, and across the board with the resistance. So, the United States is not going to win this war, come what may, but it was after the United States imposed maximum pressure sanctions, after it murdered the leader, after they imposed after last year's war, 12-day war, after all this, we saw the funerals in Tehran, in the holy cities of Mashhad and Qom, and in the holy cities of Najaf and Karbala in Iraq. The United States is failing. Now, these people can pretend all they want that they're winning, just like the Secretary of War has destroyed all of our missiles. But at the end of the day, reality keeps hitting them in the head, and they don't seem to recognize that what's hitting them in the head is reality.
Right. Yeah. And that's going to continue on. One last thing I want to ask you about, which you just mentioned, Iraq there. Was on Fox News last night on the Jesse Waters show, he had this comment that, the oil situation is really starting to kick in now. The United States is he claims they're going to open up the Strait of Hormuz. We'll leave that aside for the moment. But he said, listen, we just signed a bunch of deals with Iraq to get to two separate oil packages to have a new pipeline that's going to bypass the Strait of Hormuz and another one that's going to allow some new drilling, I think, by Chevron, if I'm not mistaken, whichever it was, a couple of different oil companies. But I also remember when President Trump hosted the Iraqi prime minister, is that part of the deal was the removal of the United States Armed Forces. And I understand that either it already has happened or it's about to happen, where that same prime minister is going to Tehran to maybe have some more deals. What can you tell us about the reality of the current relationship with Iran and oil?
The reality is that if they want to develop pipelines, it will take years. But even if they do develop pipelines, if Iran doesn't want that oil exported, they can bomb the source of that oil. And the United States is very unpopular in Iraq anyway. So the Iraqi people despise the United States. There is a minority in the north among the Kurdish groups and in the west that support the United States, but most Iraqis don't. There are a number of reasons for this. One is that Iraq, when it exports its oil, it has to go to a bank in the United States. And the United States tells the Iraqi government whether it can have its money or not. They spoon feed the Iraqi government with its own money. What does Iran do? Iran, when it has extra gas and when it has extra electricity, I don't know if it has extra now because of the war, it exports it to Iraq. Because of the U.S. sanctions, the Iraqi government is not allowed to pay Iran for its oil, for its gas, and its electricity. But Ayatollah Khamenei, the martyr Ayatollah Khamenei, has always told different governments, leave it alone. Let them have the gas and oil, the gas and electricity, because the people of Iraq need it. They have a shortage of electricity and gas. So Iran, which is under maximum pressure sanctions by the United States, gives effectively free electricity and gas to Iraq to help the Iraqi people. And the Americans strangle the Iraqis and say, you do as we say, otherwise you do not get your oil well. Who is going to be popular? And who is going to last in the long run? And who is Iraq's neighbor? So they can sign all the agreements that they want for 10 years down the road. But, by then, I think we're going to be living in a very different world.
Yeah, well, I worry about that day, what it's going to look like for the entire region as well as the global economy. Last question I want to ask you is something that I have seen. It's a little bit more on the margins, but I just wonder if you have any thoughts on the matter. There has been some arguments here of late, and it's been both in some media in the West, as well as some out of Russia and out of the Middle East. And that is, if the war goes south, and especially if it goes back into a full-scale war where it's both sides against the other, and Iran really unleashes its missile forces and starts to degrade, like this desalination plants, like the energy infrastructure, because if we hit theirs, and of course they'll do as you suggested here, that there is the possibility that Iran could then mobilize ground forces to actually move into some areas like Kuwait and others and actually seize control of some of those oil fields. Is that just crazy talk, or is there any genuine consideration of that?
Actually, I think what is more imminent is the possibility that Yemen could enter Saudi Arabia, first of all, destroy their oil facilities and then enter Saudi Arabia. They have a huge army. And the Saudis are very vulnerable, and now their export wealth is they can't use the Strait of Hormuz and they can't use the Bab al-Mandab, and it's not just about oil, it's all goods. So the Saudis are in big trouble. Then you have the resistance in Iraq. The resistance in Iraq is larger than Hezbollah with all of its reserve forces. So you have in Iraq maybe 150,000, 200,000 people who are affiliated to the resistance, and they are.
And when you say resistance, you mean Iranian resistance?
Yes, supportive of the Iranians, those who during the 40 days of fighting were firing at U.S. bases, but the resistance hadn't gone up very high on the escalation ladder. So there is always restraint, as there is now. But if there is all-out war, that's the scenario you're discussing. If there is all-out war, then the Iraqi resistance itself can take Kuwait easily. And if the Iraqis take Kuwait and want it for themselves, I'm pretty sure that the Iranians will be very fine. You know, they'll be quite fine with that.
And could this Iraqi resistance operate without the willingness or even participation of the Iraqi or the actual ISF, the Iraqi security forces?
Iraq is very complicated. Their relationship is quite good. And as I said, Iraqis, we saw the funeral of Ayatollah Khamenei in Najaf and Karbala. Iraqis, you know, their relationship with Iran is very good. Their anger towards the United States is clear as day. So they're not going to be fighting against each other. This is something that the Americans don't, you know, the American government doesn't understand. Iraq, which is a major country, opposes the United States. Yemen opposes the United States. Who are the U.S. allies? Kuwait, Qatar, the Emirates. I mean, these are not, they produce oil and gas, but they're not powers. They may have a lot of money in the bank, but they don't have a real military. And we saw Saudi Arabia fight against Yemen, Saudi Arabia and the Emirates together fight against Yemen with all their the tens of thousands of mercenary forces that they paid for to fight against Yemen, and ultimately they failed. And the United States is not popular right now. If people went online, when you look at the comment sections in Arabic media, people across the region in the Arab world are supporting Iran, not the United States. So this is not a war that I think, I don't see any scenario where the United States wins. And it could go south, as you said. It could end. It will still be bad. All the scenarios go south.
Right.
But in some terribly, you know, bad south, some less so. In no scenario can I envisage a situation where the United States does not lose.
Yeah, and I'll just tell you this: if the scenario that you posited there with the Iraqi security forces and what the Yemenis, the Houthis armed forces, Ansar Allah may do to Saudi Arabia down there, this wouldn't be like 1991 when Saddam Hussein took over Kuwait. The U.S. armed forces that exist back then doesn't exist right now, and we could not go in and just expel them because we don't have the ground forces for it. Or any, now we don't even have the resources and the bases, and we would never be able to land like my forces did. I came in with the U.S. 2nd Cavalry and landed at Jabal in Saudi Arabia and had the ease of getting everything off the boards and everything and then moving in to take off the Republican Guards. That would never happen now. So if that scenario happens, if we get foolish and start to this war and it turns into a ground fight, no one's going to be able to save Kuwait this time. So let's just hope that we don't get to that.
Or Saudi Arabia. If Yemen moves in, if Iraq moves, I mean, Saudi won't last. If the United States starts targeting Iran's critical infrastructure, I think all these regimes will collapse anyway.
God help us if we get into that, because that would almost certainly thrust us into a Great Depression. Almost how could it not, because of the disruption of energy supplies. Let's hope we don't get into that, that somehow sanity prevails and we can at least end this on a bad situation and not a catastrophic one. But we thank you so much for coming on today and providing this clarity. It's what a lot of people don't want to hear, but it's the reality, and that's what we need a lot of right now. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you. I don't take any pleasure in saying this sort of thing, but I think I have to say it because people have to know what Fox News and what MSNBC and CNN and the BBC and so on are not saying.
Indeed, that's exactly why we have this channel. So thank you. And we appreciate you guys. Be back in about 2.5 minutes. Larry Johnson is going to be on to give his take on a lot of the things that we're talking about here today, but as well as things going on in the Russia-Ukraine war. You always want to see Larry the Shirt Johnson, and you will be pleased in about 2 minutes from now. See you then. You know, I don't try to talk you into buying gold or tell you how to run your stock portfolio, but there is a way you can help us. Subscribe, hit that like button, and share this with somebody you love.